Hello, good evening, good day, and welcome to the Indian Interest Podcast. After a gap of a couple of weeks, it's great to be back. I was traveling for a bit, and I am back at my home base, and we're back. We're back live, and it's great to be back. I hope you're all doing very well. And we're going to discuss some interesting things today. Lots has happened in the past 2 weeks. Every week goes by, lots of new things happen. That's how the geopolitical scenario is these days. But before we do that, let's take a look at who all is there with us on this on the live chat. I can see Sri Hari, Arun, Ritik, Sammi, Paraj, Bimla, Jasman Raj, Prashant, Will, Nair, Matteo Perez, Oktarsh, Appleseed, Chieftain, Liger, Durga, Joseph Stalin is there with us. Wonderful to see you, sir. RSR fighter, Dr. Suryakant, Narayan, Sudhir, Animesh, Prashant, Siddhant, Harmonica Hero, Rajat Chopra, Ashutosh, Karan, Fatty Just Ate, Jatin, Shivam, Jigar, Hello Tom, Changes, Modi, Rakshit, Ankan Bag, Bonjour, Samarth Acharya Jay, Atharva Singh Chauhan, Chiching, good evening, Shubhajit, 02 Waifu, Wisdom School, Shivansh, Manish, Ankit, Yuvraj, Keshav, Priyanshi, Yashvardhan, Crick, Bik, Hero, GK, VNT, Anant, Martian is there, Shiva, Chesson Blocked, Likhita, Animesh, Vinit, Prince Chauhan, Harsh Negi, Aryavanshi, Manmath, Ritvik, Vidash, Lage Raho Online, Vladimir Adityanath is back, Suman Show, The Suman Show, Divyansh, and lots of other people. I cannot possibly greet you all, but thank you so much for being on the live stream. I really appreciate it. I'm very grateful. So, let's now begin today's episode, and we have some interesting developments to discuss. So what shall we talk about first? I think you've all seen the thumbnail, so let's get into those matters first, shall we? Let us discuss the news that came in recently. So let's put that on the screen. So, you know, the past year, I've spoken about this several times. And I also spoke about this, if I'm not mistaken, on the last episode of last year, of 2022, in which I recap the events of the year, and I kind of tried to look into what could happen in 2023. And I had said that 2023 is going to be an extremely important year for India and the US. It's going to be a pivotal year for India and the US, because 2024 is the election year in both the nations, in the largest democracy, and if I'm not mistaken, the US is the second largest democracy. And obviously, India is the oldest democracy. Some people may disagree, but that's fine. So, 2023 is going to be an extremely important year. Now, let's talk about India. We know what's happening in the US. Lots of people are, not lots of people, but some people are now throwing their hats in the ring for the presidential, as presidential nominees and all that. Interesting things happening in the US, but let's talk about India. So in India, this is going to be a very important year, very political year, and it's just warming up. And I had said this, that there's going to be a lot of interference and attempts to interfere in the electoral process and in democratic process in India from outside India, mainly from the West. And this is something we started seeing in the aftermath, in the immediate aftermath of the Ukraine war. You know, concerted social media campaign against India from various so-called experts and writers and think tanks and journalists and just opinion makers and things like that. A very strong concerted campaign against India, trying to portray India as being pro-dictatorship, pro-invasion, pro-war, pro-Putin, pro-Russia, all that, when India is just minding its own business like everybody else, like most of the world. I mean, the international community is just a few nations, according to these people. Most of the nations have stayed neutral, and so has India. India will look out for its own interests. So there's been this concerted effort over the past year, and we're going to see much more of that this year, so that they can influence the electoral campaign, the electoral proceedings in India. Because, see, from the perspective of the West, like I've said many times before, they would like to see a weak government come to power in India. A weak, malleable, pliable government. If that comes to power in India, it will be great for the West, so that they can start, interfering and controlling India and using India the way they would like India to be used. They would like to see India act as a convenient counterweight to China. And that role will certainly suit the West, but they don't want to see India rise too much and become maybe potentially the next China in the next 20 years or 30 years. They don't want that to happen. So they don't want India to rise, but they want India to stay where it is, and India should counterbalance China. That's the role they would like India to play. And for that to happen, they need a weak government in India, which will do whatever the West says. The current government in India is enabling India's rise. That's what we are seeing. It's refusing to bow down and kowtow to various demands, whether it's from the West, whether it's from China or anywhere else. So this government is extremely inconvenient, the Modi government. They don't want this government to come back to power in 24. So they would like to interfere in the electoral proceedings in India. And you're going to see a lot of that this year. So that's what I had said, and we are seeing more of that now. So let's put this on the screen. Where is the screen? So it all goes back to Mr. Soros, Mr. George Soros, who is, he's currently the main protagonist, antagonist, whichever way you want to see it. He's the guy. So he has been in the news of late for the things that he has said. So this is an example of that. This is Soros speaks on Adani, says Modi is no Democrat, blames him for violence against Muslims and all that. I mean, who is he to speak about these things? And what business is it of his, right? That's a question most Indians are asking. So that's what he has done. It's been in the news. You can see this on Twitter as well. The speech that he gave, well, he's over 90 now. He's a elderly gentleman. He is hardly able to stand and speak, but still is going ahead and doing this. So this clearly is an attempt to interfere in the internal matters of India. And you know, the way Mr. Soros is portrayed in the media, the mainstream media, Western media, even other media, is he's portrayed as an investor and a philanthropist. So let's take a look at that, shall we? So this is, first of all, the news itself. So Soros went ahead and said the things that he said, and then this time, for a change, the Indian government has responded. Dr. Jaishankar, our external affairs minister, has supposedly slammed him and said that he's old, rich, opinionated and dangerous. So that's the news. Now let's take a look at how the media portrays Mr. Soros. So this is Al Jazeera. Now Al Jazeera is... One would expect that they would have a pro-Arab agenda, but clearly over here you can see that it's pro Mr. Soros. So it's an article about apparently what's Hungary's campaign behind George Soros, and let's see how they portray him. Rights groups and watchdogs say a Hungarian government campaign against investor and philanthropist George Soros has reached blah blah blah. So they are portraying Mr. Soros as an investor and a philanthropist. Isn't that interesting, right? Now let's take a look at, Mr. Soros is not merely anti-India. He is much more than that. So let's take a look at this. This is an Israeli publication. It writes about George Soros's negative interactions with the Jewish world. You can take a look at this if you wish. You can Google it and search it up yourself. There is this tweet from the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC. George Soros has a long history of backing anti-Israel groups, now is giving $1 million to help support anti-Israel candidates and attack pro-Israel Democrats. So there you go. Now you have this as well. Once again, Hungary. This is an old article from The Guardian. Hungary passes anti-immigrant stop Soros laws. So he was trying to, you know, facilitate immigration into various European countries. We know what happened in the past decade. Lots and lots of military age young men pouring into Europe. I mean, typically refugees are helpless people, women and children mostly. But you have this big influx of military age fit young men who seem to have participated in military action, who are all pouring into Europe. Where are the women? Where are the children? None of them. So yeah, it's clearly an artificially mediated migration that was being done. And Hungary is one nation that stood resolutely against that. So once again, it's being portrayed as a stop Soros law or whatever. I mean, that's how it was portrayed in 2018. Now, let's understand who Mr. Soros is. He is a Hungarian Jew, right? You can see Hungary is not fond of Mr. Soros. He's Hungarian. You can see the Jewish people, Israel is not fond of Mr. Soros. This AIPAC, which is a Jewish organization, American Jewish organization, is not fond of Mr. Soros. He is a Hungarian Jew. Now, if you look at his background, it's quite sketchy and rather shady. He's more than 90 years old, so clearly he was born before the Second World War. During the Second World War, well, you can look it up yourself. You don't have to take my word for it. He was a Nazi collaborator. He was Jewish. He pretended to be Christian, and he used to actively accompany Nazis for the purpose of identifying Jews and for helping the Nazis confiscate the property of Jewish people and to help the Nazis deport Jewish people to concentration camps, and eventually they would make their way to gas chambers. So that's what Mr. Soros did. He collaborated with the Nazi regime and pretended to be a Christian despite being a Jew himself. Yeah. And later on, he has spoken about this very openly, and he has said that he has no guilt, he has no regrets about this. So that's that shows you a little bit, gives you a little bit of insight into the mind of Mr. Soros. Now, why is he so rich? Why is he so powerful? Well, Mr. Soros is not an investor. He is not an entrepreneur. He's not a businessman. He's a hedge fund billionaire. So typically, the billionaires that we see, the billionaires that we know, people like Elon Musk or Steve Jobs or Warren Buffett or the Tatas in India or the Ambanis or the Adanis or whoever else, these people build things. They create value and offer value to society. In exchange for that, they receive money. The more people you help and the more value you create for more people, the more money society gives you back in exchange. That's how people become rich. That's the secret formula for becoming rich. Solve problems, and the more people you help, the richer you become. That's how society rewards you for the value that you create. So people like Elon Musk or Steve Jobs or the Tatas and whoever else, Ambani, Adani, Buffett, etc., you can think of as many as you want, they have all in some way or the other created value, and that's why they have been able to become so rich. What has Mr. Soros built? He has never built anything. What Mr. Soros, the way he became rich is by carrying out attacks on organized attacks on the economies of various nations. So he attacked the economy of the UK. He attacked the economy of Asia, the Asian tigers, Thailand, etc. He attacked the economy of France and much more. And by doing that, he makes money. He has made a whole lot of money. He's a billionaire. And then he uses this money that he has made to influence the media, to influence the media of various nations, to influence the Western media, to influence the education systems, interfere in the education systems of other nations, to interfere in, to influence elections in various nations, and to topple governments across the world. In, the standard regime change operation that the various U.S. agencies carry out. So let's take a look at a little bit of his history in case you need to see it for yourself. So, we saw this. Okay, this is an article from 2016. It's from the Insider magazine, Business Insider. It's from Business Insider. Here's how George Soros broke the Bank of Thailand. So I spoke about the Asian economic crisis of 1997, was it? 1997, which brought about a big recession in Asia. It affected the major economies of that time in Asia, Thailand, South Korea, and various other nations. But before that, let's talk about the money machine, his quantum fund. So I spoke about his attack against the Bank of England, against the English, the UK's economy. The quantum fund's bet against the Bank of India, England in 1992 is probably the most famous trade, and much more. So he essentially organized a short selling attack on the British pound. That's what he did in 1992. And he tried to destroy the UK's economy. Now, why would... So Mr. Soros is obviously now... is a US citizen now. So why? We know that the UK and the US are very strong, very closely aligned. The US has a bunch of four very closely allied nations, the so-called Five Eyes group of nations, the US, Canada, the UK, Australia, and New Zealand. The five English-speaking nations, the five closest allies or vassals of the US. So why would the US do this to the UK through Mr. Soros? So understand something. Until 1998, there was a long-running campaign of terror in the UK. The troubles, the Irish troubles, it all originated in the UK's invasion and occupation of Ireland. Yes, Ireland is Northern Ireland. Ireland is still UK occupied territory. Northern Ireland is still crying out for freedom from the UK, from the English. So there was this big campaign. We had the Sinn Féin, this organization that was fighting for freedom for Ireland, and various other organizations. And they carried out various terrorist attacks in England, in the UK, in London. There was this infamous mortar attack on the hotel in which Margaret Thatcher, then Prime Minister of the UK, was staying. She escaped because she got lucky, and much more. And then you had the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, April 1998, which ended this period of all this, which was called the Troubles. Now, ask yourself this question. If an organization in British-occupied territory is carrying out a campaign of terrorism and attacks and violent resistance against the UK, where is the funding coming from? Where are the arms and ammunition and weapons coming from? Where does it come from? That's the question you have to ask yourself. And the funny thing is, after Mrs. Thatcher retired from politics, then you had this time period when it was John Major who was the Prime Minister of the UK, and he again, during his time also there was this terrorism. It's only when Mr. Tony Blair became the Prime Minister that everything suddenly changed. The Troubles ended, the Good Friday Agreement happened, and all just like that, the armed insurgency evaporated. What's the cause? Well, Mr. Tony Blair aligned himself extraordinarily closely with the US. He has been accused of, in writing, of being a US lapdog. So once he comes to power, everything becomes fine. Yeah. Some people would allege that maybe the US was funding this, the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, and all that stuff that was happening in the UK. Some people would allege that. I mean, the US has a track record of doing that. The US funded and financed Pakistani terrorism in India for decades. We know that. I think the whole world knows this. So, yeah, they were possibly, allegedly, trying to coerce the UK to become more pro-US. Margaret Thatcher was a very very strong, independent prime minister. They called her the Iron Lady. And she refused to bend to the US demands, and she pursued a very independent foreign policy. It's only after Tony Blair came to power that the US has become, that the UK has become a complete vassal, lapdog of the US. Today, that's what it is. It's simply an extension of the US. It has no, independent foreign policy whatsoever. So it all started with Tony Blair. So in 1992, the situation was still very different. The UK still had an independent foreign policy. And the US wanted to coerce the UK and to make it bend to their will. And possibly one could speculate or allege that the short-selling attack of Mr. Soros on the British pound, which was aimed at destroying and wrecking the UK's economy, would have been part of that. So 1992, as you can see on the screen, Mr. Soros attacked. He tried to destroy the UK's economy through his short-selling attack on the British pound. Then, as you can see here, George Soros broke the Bank of Thailand, precipitated the Asian financial crisis of 1997. And, as a result of the Asian financial crisis, lots of people lost their livelihoods and their investments. Lots of careers were destroyed. Lots of families were bankrupted. Lots of people were bankrupted. And this entire thing spiraled in such a way that it led to the creation of the G20. The G20 group of nations, this is the year of India's presidency of the G20. I've spoken about this multiple times. So the G20 group of nations was created in 1998. The first 1999. The first summit was in 1999. It was created in response to this disastrous financial crisis in Asia, which was triggered off by George Soros. So he is not somebody who creates value for society. He destroys economies, That's how he carries out attacks against economies and makes money in that manner. So that's what he did. And then he also attacked he was convicted by the French legal system between 2000 and 2002, 2005, somewhere around that, for insider trading, which is a crime. So once again, this is an old article. I don't have access to the New York Times. I've not purchased the subscription because I don't need to. But there you have it. Insider trading conviction of Soros is upheld in France. This is an article from 2005. So that's the deal with Mr. Soros. He doesn't create any value. The value that he provides to certain masters who use him to achieve certain geopolitical and geostrategic and economic objectives. And we spoke about what those objectives are: interference in the internal affairs of other nations. So Mr. Soros has become extremely rich by leveraging these methods. He is a convicted criminal in France, insider trading, which is obviously a crime. He has deep ties with various anti-India groups. He has, as we see here, he has stakes in Indian startups. He owns 2.26 million shares of something or the other. So he has deep ties with various NGOs, with startups, with a wide variety of anti-India groups, which attack India in a wide variety of ways. There's no one way to attack India or any other nation or any nation. You can attack a nation through a 360-degree perspective, through a wide variety of ways and methods and techniques. This gentleman has links to anti-India media. I mean, I'm not going to show you all the details, but you can look it up. Lots of people have written Twitter threads and explained with links and with references what those ties are. So he has links with anti-India media outlets. He has relations and ties and links with certain, what would you call them, political factions. Yes. And he has ties with various extremist organizations as well. Rather shady or extremist organizations. And what's his philosophy? So let's take a look at this tweet by Savitri Mumukshu. So this is a book that he wrote, The Crisis of Global Capitalism, in which he has written that the sovereignty of states must be subordinated to international law and international institutions. So he's a sinister European imperialist disguised as a humane anti-capitalist who wants to rule India by remote control. Listen, the principle of the Westphalian system of governance, of international relations that we live under, is of non-interference in the internal matters of sovereign nations. India is a sovereign nation. Then what business does this fine gentleman have speaking about, subordinating the sovereignty of states to international law and international relations? First of all, who decides what international law is and who decides what these international institutions is? That's the question. Typically, these so-called international institutions are the IMF, the World Bank, the UN, which are mainly run, controlled by the US, by the West, to some extent by China as well. International law, who writes that? Well, these organizations write that. So he is an imperialist. That's what he is. He's a Western imperialist. I would not say that he's a European imperialist. He's a Western imperialist. And when we talk about the West, we're talking about the US mainly. It's the US empire that we're talking about. So that's the deal with Mr. Soros. Now, please understand that he is not some great mastermind. He himself is a useful tool in somebody else's toolkit. Somebody far greater and stronger and more powerful than him. Now, who that is, it's not one person. It may be, they call it the deep state. I mean, think about it. Look at the US today. Who's the president? Who's the vice president? The president of the US, Mr. Biden, is he doesn't even know where he is often. He's not capable of taking care of himself. So how will he run the nation? Clearly, it's not Mr. Biden who's running the US. And clearly, it's not the lady, Kamala Harris, who herself is not the sharpest tool in the toolkit. Yes? So clearly somebody else somewhere at some level or at various levels is actually running the nation. The Biden presidency has totally exposed the fact that the US president doesn't run the US. So there is something, there is a deeper power at play. They call it the deep state. I mean, this is something that people have been writing about, journalists and historians and writers and other kinds of people also have been writing about this and speaking about this for almost a century. A certain US president even spoke about this during his last speech as president. He spoke about the military-industrial complex, which was an allusion to this greater power that is greater than that of the US president. So Mr. Soros is no great mastermind. He himself is a useful tool in somebody else's toolkit, in the imperial toolkit, the imperialistic toolkit, which seeks to create a uniform global world order and to subjugate all other nations and to perpetuate its power. That's the deal with Mr. Soros. And as we know, he is an old hand at various regime change schemes. We know that the US has become an expert in the regime change operation. They call it the color revolution. This has been happening for the longest time. They have orchestrated or engineered regime changes in South America, in Africa, in other parts of the world, in Iran, in lots of other parts of the world. They have tried that across the world. In the 21st century itself, they have done this in Central Asia. Think about Kyrgyzstan. Most Indians don't even know where Kyrgyzstan is. It's right next to India, but we don't know about it. So in Kyrgyzstan, you had at least three such revolutions. In 2005, you had the Tulip Revolution, so-called, which was a regime change operation, a color revolution. Then in 2010, you had the Melon Revolution, the second Kyrgyzstan revolution, which was again a regime change. And you had a third regime change in 2020. We obviously also had the Arab Spring of the early 2010s, which was a bunch of regime change operations across the Arabic nations, starting from Tunisia, if I'm not mistaken. It spread to Egypt as well and other. That was the Arab Spring, the attempt to change the regime in Syria. You had the 2014 Euromaidan Revolution regime change operation in Ukraine, which was successful, which has led to the current Ukraine conflict. And we are seeing more of this. Take a look at this. This is Mr. Anthony Blinken, Secretary of State, which means the foreign minister, equivalent of the Indian foreign minister. What does it say here? The US stands with the Nigerian people as they prepare to make their voices heard by voting in the general elections on February 25, which is today. We do not support any individual candidate for office. How nice of you, sir. Thank you. But we strongly support free, fair, and peaceful elections. What business is it of yours, Mr. Blinken? Whatever is happening in Nigeria. It's none of your business. And there you have it. This is, interference. Jake Sullivan, some kind of government official, White House National Security Advisor to the President of the US. Okay, he's an important guy. Nigeria's upcoming election will be one of the most important in 2023. The US is committed to supporting and advancing democracy and human rights and freedom in Nigeria and around the world. So Nigeria is not the last stop. There is more to come around the world. We're going to interfere around the world. So this is the deal. This is just the beginning, my friends. There is much more to come. So what we are seeing through Mr. Soros is just an appetizer. It's a foretaste of what may yet be to come as the year progresses, as the Indian general elections come near, 2024. So expect more of this. This is just the beginning. We can expect more of such what we could call Breaking India 2024 activities, more of that to come. So that's what this is about. So let's understand what Mr. Soros represents. He himself is no great mastermind. He himself is merely a tool in a much larger toolkit of a much more powerful force. He is not an autonomous, independent actor. Obviously, he enjoys what he does, destroying economies, wrecking nations, playing God. But everybody has to serve somebody. There's this Bob Dylan song, you may be the devil or you may be the Lord, but you got to serve somebody. So Mr. Soros may be the devil or maybe the God, but he clearly serves somebody. That's the deal with Mr. Soros. So that topic is done. What else shall we talk about? Yes, we'll talk about something else now. Something that lots of people in India are highly enthused about. So where is it? Yes. Let me put that on the screen now. And that is obviously the great airline deal. The Wall Street Journal says, in the largest commercial aircraft deal in aviation history, Air India has ordered 470 jets from Boeing and Airbus. Fantastic. Bloomberg says, new Air India announced a 470-plane order with Airbus and Boeing in what stands to be the largest purchase in commercial aviation history. What else? News 18. Stop that. There we go. Air India to acquire 470 planes and so on. You know, the whole thing and the same news. There is more of that. This is Bloomberg. Air India to buy 470 Boeing Airbus jets in record order. So what's happening is that Air India is purchasing aircraft, a total of 470 aircraft from two different places. From Boeing, which is a US company, and Airbus, which is a French company. 220 Boeing jets and about 250 Airbus jets. So it's kind of a balancing act, actually. But it makes sense from a variety of perspectives. So that's the deal over here. Okay, now, not only that, Air India has placed an order for 800 LEAP engines for 400 narrow-body planes. GE Aerospace says that. General Electric, which is an engine manufacturer, turbofan engines. So it's not just aircraft, it's also these engines. What else do we have? This is a breakup of that by Shiv Arur. It's the biggest order in history. The Air India order breakup, 140 Airbus A320s, 70 Airbus A321neos, 40 Airbus A350s, 190 Boeing 737 MAX aircraft. One has to be careful with that. 20 Boeing 787s and 10 Boeing 777X aircraft. So it's a total of 470 aircraft. What else do we have? And obviously, this has been a very major thing, the largest aviation deal in history. And apart from this deal of 470 aircraft, the deal also has an option for Air India to purchase about 370 more aircraft under various options and purchase rights, which will be procured from Airbus and Boeing. So this could eventually potentially become a deal for more than 800 aircraft, possibly. So it's a very major thing. And so here we have a statement from Mr. Joe Biden, apparently. I mean, from the president of the U.S., whoever it is right now, whoever is handling the press releases. Statement from President Joe Biden on Air India's historic purchase of Boeing aircraft. The U.S. can and will lead the world in manufacturing. I, Joe Biden, am proud to announce today the purchase of over 200 American-made aircraft through a historic agreement between Air India and Boeing. This purchase will support over 1 million American jobs across 44 states and blah, blah, blah. This announcement reflects the strength of the U.S.-India economic partnership. Together with Prime Minister Modi, I look forward to deepening our partnership and all those things. Wonderful. So very significant statement. It's going to create more than 1 million jobs in the U.S. Can you believe that? Here you have a statement from Monsieur Macron. The contract between Airbus and Tata Sons signed this morning marks a new stage in India and France's strategic partnership. Thank you, Narendra Modi, for your confidence in France and in our industry. Then let's take a look at Mr. Rishi Sunak. I mean, he himself has taken to Twitter. He says this is one of the biggest export deals to India in decades and a huge win for the UK's aerospace sector. So they also stand to gain a lot. With wings from Broughton and engines from Derby, this deal will support jobs throughout the country, across the country, and help deliver one of our five priorities, growing the economy. So this deal is going to help grow the UK's economy as well, apart from the US economy and the French economy. And here's an interesting tweet by Abhijit Majumdar, which I completely agree with. They used to accuse India of stealing their jobs. Today, Biden and Sunak and Macron, okay, not Mr. Macron, because the French never did that. But today, Biden and Sunak are thanking India for creating millions of jobs in the US, in the UK. Yes, how many civilizations can boast of such a rise after a millennium of murderous invasions and crippling colonization? I completely agree with this tweet. So that is the deal. So what is all this about? What does this tell us? This enormous purchase order, the largest aviation deal, single aviation deal in aviation history. So the fact that India, an Indian company, a private Indian company, is purchasing so many aircraft, it demonstrates that India is a thriving economy and it is going to thrive even more. It's an example of the optimism that you see throughout India. The India as a nation knows that it is thriving currently despite the very uncertain geopolitical climate that we are currently living in. There's a war going on, major war going on, major realignment of the geopolitical realignment, power shifts everywhere. And still, India is one bright spot in the global economy. India is thriving. India's economy is thriving. It's going to thrive even more. So we have 470 aircraft, possibly 840 aircraft eventually that will come in. We have hundreds of new trains that are being, rolled out across India, Vande Bharat trains, high-speed trains. We have 40 to 50 kilometers of new highways that are being constructed in India every single day. India is the bright spot in the global economy. So this augurs very well for India, and it demonstrates that India's economy is going to keep on growing and thriving. And, you know, that's the reason why the world is currently focusing on India. China is no longer the big news. It's India in the next few years, next decade, next couple of decades, that's going to be the big deal economically. Now, let's see something else. This is a tweet by retired Air Vice Marshal of the Indian Air Force, Air Vice Marshal Manmohan Bahadur. So he says 220 Boeings, 250 Airbus. If we do not squeeze benefits from this once in a lifetime buy, then we are duds. China threaten these two, Airbus and Boeing. Set up your integration factories in China or else. And now they have their own Chinese-made aircraft coming up. Chinese-designed and made aircraft coming up. C-919 and C-929. So the gentleman wrote this, Air Vice Marshal Bahadur wrote this a month back. So he says that India needs to take leverage this opportunity to squeeze benefits from Boeing and Airbus, possibly say that we will not go ahead with the deal unless you set up your integration factories in India or something like that. So India needs to acquire some benefits, you know, a technology transfer of some kind or you know, manufacturing in India, integration factories, that sort of thing. Yes, another tweet here. Many ways to look at this. This is from Diva Jain. Triumph of privatization or makings of a national champion, all that. Critically, Boeing and Airbus have tremendous sway in the corridors of power in Washington and Brussels, which is the EU capital. And this order will make India's voice harder to ignore by the powers that be. So she is saying that this will give India a significant geopolitical leverage in Washington and in the European Union. Now, do I agree with this? So I disagree with both these statements. And why do I say that I disagree with this tweet by the retired Air Vice Marshal and by the other lady? Why do I say this? So think about it. Look at the most successful airline that India has today, which is IndiGo. IndiGo is India's number one airline, domestic airline that we have today. Now, IndiGo has a fleet of more than 800 aircraft. It has put in multiple big purchase orders in 2005, 2010, 2015, 2020, around that time. It operates more than 800 aircraft. And these aircraft, I'm not sure what the breakup is, but you will have Boeings and you will have Airbuses in this. So the question is, what geopolitical leverage did India gain from ordering more than 800 aircraft from Boeing and Airbus? India gained no geopolitical leverage from these enormous IndiGo orders. Yes, so that's one precedent that we have to look into. That is on the record. India did not gain. Maybe the Indian government was very weak at the time. Possibly. One could say that. Yeah, one could say that the Indian government maybe did not do its job and did not take advantage of the opportunities. Let's take a different example. In Air India and Indian Airlines, the legacy aviation fleet of India in the 20th century, it almost exclusively used Boeing aircraft, jumbo jets, 747s and all that. So India was importing American-built, American-made airliners, commercial jet planes for the longest time. And yet India had no geopolitical leverage on the US. In the 1960s and 1970s, India's trade with the US was higher than India's trade with the USSR. That gave India no geopolitical leverage. And in 1971, despite this fact, despite India's trade with the US being greater, larger than the India's trade with the USSR, in 1971, the U.S. sent its aircraft carrier task force in the Bay of Bengal to intimidate India. And the USSR sent its submarine fleet, nuclear submarine fleet, to defend India. So there is no correlation here. You understand that? And once again, if you'd also look at the fact that India-China trade is bigger than India-US trade. Does it give India any geopolitical leverage with China? So it's you know, these assumptions that people make, with the greatest of respect, I disagree with them. I have given you examples just now, which show you that there is no correlation between these economic matters and geopolitical interests. So that's the deal. Now, so then what is the geopolitical? Is there any geopolitical angle to this, to this enormous purchase? So some people have even said that India is paying protection money, kind of, you know, the Hafta system. India is paying Hafta to the US so that they will leave India alone for the 2024 elections. It's not going to work like that. That's not how it's going to be. There's going to be a certain level of goodwill towards India, that India is, despite, you know, being apparently neutral on Russia's side, according to the West, in the Ukraine conflict, India is purchasing enormous quantities of Western aircraft and helping the economies of the US and the UK and France. So there's going to be a certain amount of goodwill. That is for sure. But overall, it's not going to give India any hard bargaining power or leverage, because India has been purchasing aircraft in the past and it's never worked that way ever. So that's not how it works. But overall, it's a good thing. The good news is that this is an excellent indicator of the fact that India's market is growing. I'm not sure how many people travel in India by air every year. It's definitely between 100 and 200 million passengers. And that number is going to keep on growing. And that's why that everyone knows it's going to happen. And so that's why this enormous order has been placed. And maybe many more aircraft will come in, more than 470. So this is an indicator of the growth of India's economy and the fact that India's economy is going to keep on growing. India's middle class is going to keep on becoming larger. More and more people will rise out of poverty, enter the middle class, and be able to afford flying by air. I mean, you know, in the 20th century, it was kind of a luxury to fly by air. Today, almost anybody can fly by air. It's not really that expensive, a plane ticket. You know, 4,000-5,000 rupees typically, you know, on the major routes. So these days, flying by air is really affordable. But there was a time when it was a real luxury. This shows us that India's economy is doing really well, and it's going to keep on doing very well. So that's why this is very, very good news from that perspective from India. But from the geopolitical perspective, I don't see India gaining much of, you know, geopolitical leverage, despite what some people are speculating. Now, yesterday was the 1 year anniversary of the Ukraine war. It was on February 24, 2022, that President Putin of Russia ordered the special military operation in Ukraine. That's when the Ukraine conflict began, and it's been 1 year and 1 day now. So what is the deal? What's the situation 1 year in? Okay, we haven't seen the map today, which is like, you know, not right. One must see the map. So where's the map? Here's the map. Let's put the map on the screen. Here we are. So where's Ukraine? I'm sure regular viewers of this channel will know exactly where Ukraine is. So let's go westwards from India. And here we have the Black Sea. North from the Black Sea, you have Crimea, and then you have Ukraine. So this is where the conflict is raging. What's happened over the past year? Initially, lots of people thought that the Russians will steamroll Ukraine in a week's time. But that's not what happened. the Russians, first of all, did not use their air force almost at all, apart from a few helicopters and a few, MiG or Sukhoi sorties. There's been almost no Russian air force activity in Ukraine. The Russians obviously have used a lot of missiles and other weaponry to establish air superiority over Ukraine, to degrade Ukraine's air defenses, which are greatly degraded now. All those things have happened. So the Russians have taken over currently, as we speak, about a quarter of Ukraine, the Donbas region, Luhansk, Donetsk, those regions, the eastern and southern regions of Ukraine. They already took Crimea in 2014. So that is the situation. That's the status that we are in right now. It's not been a rapid war. There's been no blitzkrieg advance. There's been no shock and awe tactics used by the Russians the way the Americans do things, just destroy entire cities in one go. Carpet bombing, doesn't matter who dies, civilians or not, who cares. So the Russians have not done that. It's been a very different methodology that they have employed in the Ukraine war. Now, what's interesting is, so we can now see the situation. Now, let's take a look at what's happening here. So on 21 February, which is 4 days ago, Mr. Putin gave a lengthy, hour-plus-long address to the Federal Assembly of Russia. It was a lengthy address in which he spoke about the Ukraine invasion also, definitely. It was mainly about that and about Russia's, deep conflict with the West, which essentially means the US. And one of the interesting things, one of the most important pieces of news that came out of this is that Mr. Putin has suspended Russia's participation in the New START treaty. So let's search for that New START. Pepsi. Start, new start. So let's take read these couple of paragraphs. Now they are using NATO to give us signals, which is in fact, it is an ultimatum whereby Russia should no questions asked, implement everything that it agreed to, including the New START treaty, whereas they will do as they please. As if there is no connection between strategic offensive weapons and, say, the conflict in Ukraine or other hostile Western actions against our country, Russia. As if there are no vociferous claims about them seeking to inflict a strategic defeat upon us. This is either the height of hypocrisy and cynicism or the height of stupidity, but they are not idiots. They are not stupid after all. They want to inflict a strategic defeat on us and also to get to our nuclear sites. In this regard, I am compelled to announce today that Russia is suspending its membership in the New START treaty. To reiterate, we are not withdrawing from the treaty, but rather suspending our participation. Before we come back to discussing this issue, we must have a clear idea of what NATO countries like France or the UK, Great Britain have at stake and how we will account for the strategic arsenals, that is, the alliance's combined offensive capabilities. Okay, that's what he has said. I'll not go into further detail. Now, what is the New START treaty? We'll take a look at Wikipedia. As always, Wikipedia is not necessarily a reliable source of information, especially when it comes to India. But let's take a look at this. So the New START treaty is reduction of strategic offensive arms. It's a nuclear arms reduction treaty between the US and the Russian Federation. It was signed in Prague in 2010. It entered into force after ratification in February 2011. This treaty calls for halving, making the number half, the number of strategic nuclear missile launchers. A new inspection and verification regime will be established. It does not limit the number of operationally inactive nuclear warheads, but only that can be stockpiled, a number in the high thousands. But it calls for the reduction of the number of strategic nuclear missile launchers. And on 21 February, Russia suspended its participation in this treaty. So once again, you have a nation that prioritizes its own national interest. It places its national interest first, and it is willing to unilaterally walk away from a treaty or at least suspend it until the time is right. So people ask me about the Indus Waters Treaty and does India have the right to withdraw from the treaty or to renegotiate the treaty? Obviously, India has the right to do it. Any self-respecting nation will prioritize its own national interest. Any self-respecting and strong nation will prioritize its national interest. Here we have the Russians unilaterally suspending their participation in the New START treaty. So that's one of the most important pieces of news that came out of Mr. Putin's speech. He spoke about a whole lot of other things. He spoke about tax reforms. Let's take a look at what he spoke about tax. So he has announced a whole lot of tax incentives for the Russian people. What does it say? So he's prioritizing purchasing advanced domestic IT solutions and AI in enhanced products. So these are big tax cuts for Russian companies. What else do we have? Adjustments to the taxation system for the benefit of Russian families. Families with two or more children have been relieved of paying tax on the sale of housing and other things as well. So all kinds of reforms are being rolled out in Russia, which will benefit the people of Russia. That's what one of the interesting things that came out of Mr. Putin's recent speech. But mainly it was about geopolitics, about START and other things as well. Now, what else is happening? So recently Mr. Biden was in Ukraine. Take a look at this. And before he left for Ukraine, he called Kremlin, which means he called Mr. Putin. And it is said over here that he called Mr. Putin to give advanced warning that he was going to Ukraine. What it actually means is that he had to take permission from Mr. Putin to go to Ukraine. That please don't shoot us down. We are coming. Let me inform you. Please note that I am coming to you. I am going to Ukraine. So make sure you don't shoot me down. Essentially, that's what it was. So this is a very nice diplomatic way of writing this headline. What it really means is that Mr. Biden or somebody on his behalf called Mr. Putin and essentially took permission to visit Ukraine. And there was this entire media thing, and you know, lots of photographs were publicized of Mr. Biden and Mr. Zelensky together and all those things. So it was a PR exercise, and that's what happened there. There is escalation, of course. The Russian state TV says the US has declared war after Crimea comments. What comments? Following reports, the White House is approval of targeted strikes on Crimea, which would represent a major escalation. So yes, escalation is going on. What else? Suspected Iranian weapons seized by the US Navy may go to Ukraine. So, you know, the West is running out of weapons, apparently. They are considering sending a cache of arms to help Kiev in its battle against Russia. Arms seized by the US Navy from Iran. Thousands of seized weapons and more than a million rounds of ammunition once bound for Iran-backed fighters in Yemen. There's a proxy war happening in Yemen, you know, which, I have spoken about in the past. I even have a podcast with Dr. Isa Bloomi on this topic, a very interesting podcast. You can take a look at it if the topic interests you. So, more than 5,000 assault rifles, 1.6 million rounds of small arms ammunition, a small number of anti-tank missiles, and more than 7,000 proximity fuses. So all that they are considering sending to Ukraine. Interesting. What else? The UK is training Ukrainians to fight in the Western way with less ammunition. Well, that's very interesting. Why is it the Western way? The Western way has typically been to carpet bomb entire cities with a lot of ammunition. So what happened here? So for the longest time, they've been saying, the Western media has been saying, that the Russians are running out of arms and ammunition. They're running out of missiles. They're running out of other things. Well, now it is becoming very apparent. It's Ukraine that's running out of ammunition. And not just Ukraine, it's the West that's running out of ammunition. So they are now trying to train the Ukrainian army and the Ukrainian fighters to use less ammunition. And they are calling it the Western way. They can call it whatever they want, but well, it makes things kind of clear. Now, before we come to India's the Indian angle in this entire matter, let's take a look at what are the lessons learned from the Ukraine conflict. I may have spoken about this before, but let's consider this matter once again. What are the lessons that we can learn from the Ukraine conflict? See, every big war typically gives you a number of lessons. A war is a terrible thing, obviously. You know, it causes a lot of destruction, a lot of death and suffering and all those things. But from a military perspective, from a geostrategic perspective, from a strategic perspective, a war is, in a way, it's like a laboratory. It's like a lab in which new weapons and tactics and strategies are tested. And typically, every century or every 50 years, new weapons and new tactics make their way into the military domain. So in World War I, you had a whole new set of tactics and methods that were employed. New weapons, completely brand new weapons that had never seen military use. All of that was put into play in the First World War. It totally revolutionized warfare. The old style of fighting had to be discarded, you know, marching in formation and wearing bright, colorful military uniforms. All that had to be discarded because of the new weapons and tactics and strategies. World War II again brought in new innovations. Now, the Ukraine conflict has become kind of a proving ground for new methods of warfare and new tactics and strategies and new technologies. So, first of all, we are seeing a significant amount of cyber warfare and hacking in the Ukraine war. The hacking of power grids, the hacking of communications systems, possibly even space communication systems. So this is something that we are seeing right now in the Ukraine conflict. It's become kind of routine, cyber warfare and hacking activities in the Ukraine war. So this is something every nation needs to be cognizant of. The other thing we are seeing, which is non-kinetic war, is the role of media and the role of propaganda. It's the weaponization of social media, which has reached new heights in the past year, all part of the Ukraine conflict, you know, the extended Ukraine conflict. We are seeing the conflict being played out in the propaganda domain, in the social media domain, in the mainstream media domain. So media has been weaponized. Social media has been weaponized to unprecedented levels. We are also seeing open source intelligence being used, being leveraged to fight, to acquire targets and eliminate targets. And that much of that is happening on social media. We obviously are witnessing the effect of sanctions, the way in which sanctions can be leveraged against a nation. I mean, if they can do it to Russia, they can do it to any other nation. So it can be done. So sanctions are a very big, one of the most powerful tools in the arsenal of the West, of the US. It's because of the fact that the US dollar is the world's reserve currency. And, you know, people have been talking about de-dollarization. We are nowhere near that right now. But yes, it is certainly on the agenda. So that's sanctions. Sanctions are a big deal. So that's something that every nation, major nation has to, that lesson has to be learned. Then the fact that missiles have played such a big role in this war, the Russian Air Force is completely, almost completely not being used in the war, in the military campaign. It's missiles. The Russians have been using missiles, thousands of missiles. Maybe they must have used possibly 5, 6, 7, maybe 10,000 missiles by now to target Ukrainian infrastructure and military positions and all that, you know, pinpoint strikes, surgical strikes, essentially. So that tells you that missiles are an important, very important component of any military strategy. A nation like India needs to have a massive stockpile of missiles. I would say India would want to have a stockpile of more than 10,000 missiles of various kinds, cruise missiles and various other kinds of missiles. I'm not talking about ballistic missiles. I'm talking not strategic missiles, but tactical missiles, cruise missiles, you know, short range, medium range, long range, 1,000 kilometers, 1,500 kilometers. That's those ranges, cruise missiles and various other missiles. So that's a very big lesson that one must learn from the Ukraine conflict. The other thing is the fact that unmanned systems are now an integral part of warfare. Unmanned systems, many of those are equipped with AI, artificial intelligence. We are seeing the use of thousands of small, cheap, and very often civilian manufactured drones in the conflict. Every unit in the Ukrainian forces and the Russian forces now uses these unmanned systems, these small, cheap, disposable drones that are still very effective. You have the use of drones. You have the use of loitering munitions, suicide drones. The Russians are using Iranian-made drones, the Shahed and Mohajer systems. And obviously, to use these systems effectively, you need to use GPS. GPS is a US system. So the Russians are using their GLONASS system. India has a smaller, more modest a little less ambitious system called NAVIC, a constellation of, I think, 7 satellites that provides India coverage in the Indian Ocean region and in the Indian subcontinent and somewhat beyond that. So India needs to become a little more ambitious because we would need to have redundancy in this as well. Let's say somebody decides to take out his satellites. What will you do? You're going to lose access to the positioning information and the US may refuse it. And you cannot rely on other nations for these critical technologies. So this is a big nation, a big lesson for India to learn. And we have also witnessed the first drone-on-drone dogfights in over Ukrainian airspace. You know, typically, historically, the dogfights have been between fighter planes, Sukhoi versus F-16 or whatever against whatever. That's typically how it's been. A fighter plane with a human being inside against another fighter plane with another human being inside. That's typically how dogfights have gone. Now we are seeing drone-on-drone dogfights in Ukraine. So I think the Indian Air Force needs to be very cognizant of that. The Indian Air Force training program is totally centered around dogfighting, about being the best dogfighter in the world. The Indian Armed Forces need to, well, I'm sure they have the right people and, you know, they know what is to be done, but this is something that needs to be prioritized. The era of human dogfighting is soon going to end. We need to start investing in maneuverable, hyper-maneuverable drones, cheap drones, mass-produced drones that are still effective, highly lethal. That is the future. So these are some of the learnings that come out of the Ukraine war. And it's very important that India acts in an agile manner. You can't wait for 20 years to adopt new technologies. That's typically how it's been with the Indian Armed Forces. And I don't blame the armed forces for this. I blame the politicians and the bureaucrats for this. So India needs to be at the forefront of these things. India needs the Indian planners, strategists, leaders. They need to be able to anticipate what's coming instead of following in everybody else's wake. So these are some of the lessons that are very important and that these are the lessons India needs to learn at the earliest from what's happening. It's the Ukraine war is kind of a laboratory of new technologies. Instead of, see, we are not having to use our money to try this out, to test it out. We are already seeing what works, what doesn't work. So let's use this. So that's what India needs to do. Now, let's talk about India's role. Like I was saying, what's India's role in all these things? So let's take a look at this tweet from Velina Chakarova. India has replaced Europe as the dominant buyer of Russia's Western crude oil. And this is a graphic. So as you can see, it's from January 22 all the way to January 23. So the orange part is the Eastern crude and the light blue part, that is Russia's Western crude. And India has now replaced Europe as the dominant buyer of Russia's Western crude. Very interesting development. What else? Indian refiners may buy Russian oil for domestic demand and export finished products. So that's what India is doing now. India is purchasing enormous quantities of Russian crude oil. It is using that primarily for the domestic demand, internal Indian consumption within India, but it's also refining these products and exporting them to the West, to the US and to the UK. So India is doing well from this trade, and why not? That's what's happening. Apart from this, we had this interesting development. Mr. Ajit Doval, India's national security advisor to the Prime Minister, he recently met Mr. Putin. He participated in this dialogue with Mr. Putin and various other security officials of the region surrounding Afghanistan. And he had a meeting with Mr. Putin. So that's very interesting. So India and Russia are closely coordinating on a number of matters. We don't know what those matters are. Those will not be disclosed. But there is close coordination that we are witnessing between India and Russia. And this is an indication of that. This was this report is from February 13, so about 10, 12 days ago, less than 2 weeks ago. What else is happening? There's going to be a visit of the German Chancellor to India. It's already ongoing, if not already over. But some sobering poll numbers, that's what Mr. Tyson Barker says. over 50% of Indians see Russia as an ally that shares its interests and all that. So take a look at this. So how countries view Russia. The US sees Russia very negatively. So does the EU, and so does the UK, the Britain, so-called Great Britain. When it comes to India, the dark blue segment is people who see Russia as an ally. The light blue segment is people who see Russia as a necessary partner with whom we must strategically cooperate. The beige thing says it represents people who are not sure of what's happening, who don't know anything. And the red is a rival and adversary and all that. So more than 50% of Indians see Russia in this poll, whatever the poll population was, they see Russia as an ally that shares India's interests and values. When it comes to China, it's less than 40% who see Russia as an ally. But overall, the positive sentiment towards Russia is almost the same when it comes to India and China. But many more Indians feel that Russia is a nation that shares India's interests and values as well. Whereas the Chinese, it's much much lower than the Indian numbers. So, and Turkey also sees Russia quite positively. But the Turks are very pragmatic. Most of them see Russia as a necessary partner, not as a nation that shares interests and values. So it's the Indians who feel, the majority of whom feel, that Russia shares India's interests and values. I would say this is an extremely naive thing to believe. Recently, I've said that, it looks like India, the people of India, are becoming less naive in a geopolitical perspective. They understand geopolitics better. But this kind of, tells me that I was kind of wrong. I kind of jumped the gun. Russia does not share India's values. It may share many of India's interests, not all of India's interests, not many of India's interests, maybe some of India's interests. The important thing between Russia and India, and in India-Russia relationship, is that there are almost no conflicting interests. There is almost no conflict of interest. There's only convergence of interest. So that's why there is a significant amount of cooperation between India and Russia. But when it comes to values, please understand, Russia does not share the civilizational or cultural values that India has. It does not share those values. Russia is an Orthodox Christian nation. Those values are Abrahamic values. Even though that the Russian Orthodox Christianity may be an more Eastern form of Christianity compared to what you have in the West, still, these are Abrahamic values. Russia does have a significant Islamic population. Russia does have a small Buddhist population as well. Russia sees itself as a multicultural, multi-ethnic nation. That's what Mr. Putin keeps on reiterating. But yet, when it comes to values, Russian values are Christian Orthodox values. So understand this. So I totally disagree with those Indians who believe that Russia shares India's values. But yes, it does share many of India's interests, and there are no conflicting interests, almost no conflicting interests, almost none. I'm not saying none at all, but very few conflicting interests when it comes to Russia and India. So this poll kind of tells me that I was wrong about Indians not being naive, being less naive these days. Indians are still very naive, unfortunately. It kind of saddens me, but that's the deal. These are facts. Now, this is a tweet by Ulrika Franke, whoever she is. And she's kind of unhappy with the Indian numbers. So, well, deal with it. What can I say? Now, I have been speaking about a possible Russian winter offensive in Ukraine. Yes. I spoke about the Rasputitsa season, the mud season. Ukraine is a very flat piece of land. It's a very large nation. It's almost as flat as a pancake. There are no hills. There are no valleys. There are no mountains. It's just flat. And it's all plains, flat plains. And it has two mud seasons. One is in autumn, September, October, November, mainly October, November. And the second Rasputitsa season, the mud season, is in spring, February, March, maybe up to April, mainly February, March. And that's when the ground becomes soggy, the ice and the snow melts, and you have mud everywhere. And it is at this time that it is highly disadvantageous to have rapid infantry charges. And it's not good time for invading. It's not a good time for invading Ukraine. So clearly the winter offensive has not materialized. Now, we don't know what Mr. Putin is thinking, what he's planning, what his long-term plans are. We don't know what the thinking in the Russian military is, but they have clearly not gone ahead with a winter offensive. So what's going to happen? We don't know what's going to happen. Maybe this war will drag out 4 years. That is a possibility. Maybe there will be a spring offensive. So, you know, when it comes to the Financial Times, they're already kind of saying that Russia is preparing for a Ukraine spring offensive. So we don't know. It's all speculation at this point. I had speculated there will be a winter offensive. That did not happen after the ground froze. Now the ground will start thawing again until it'll be the second mud season. So, after that, there could be a possible spring offensive, maybe during that. We don't know. So what are the possible outcomes of the Ukraine conflict? One outcome is that there could be a very long, drawn-out war, which will go on for years. Maybe there will be a frozen conflict and Ukraine will become the next Korean Peninsula. Look at the Korean Peninsula. It's a frozen conflict. You have North Korea, which is controlled by China, South Korea, which is militarily occupied by the U.S., a bifurcated country. You could have the same thing happen in Ukraine. Maybe Russia will be happy with the quarter of Ukraine it has already captured, and it will be happy with that only. But that doesn't kind of fulfill the Russian objectives. Mr. Putin had said a year ago that his objectives were to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. Well, that clearly has not happened. So maybe there could be an offensive coming up later. So all these possibilities are in play right now. A long-term possibility is that Russia could win and take over Kiev and effect a regime change of its own and replace Mr. Zelensky by a pro-Russia puppet regime. That's a possibility. There's also a possibility that Russia will lose the conflict and it will disintegrate. All the possibilities are in play right now. But the possibility of Russia losing the conflict is remote because Russia has an extremely strong and powerful military, and it has the world's largest nuclear arsenal, and there are certain red lines that will not allow anyone to cross. So these are dangerous times. The chance, the possibility of escalation is always high, and that's always dangerous. So that's where we are when it comes to the Ukraine conflict 1 year on, nowhere close to resolution. Now, since we are talking about Russia, let's talk a little bit more about Russia and India-Russia military cooperation. Let's put something on the screen. Where are we? Where is it? Here it is. So Russia offers to supply 26 MiG-29K fighter planes to the Indian Navy. According to Rosbodin Export CEO Alexander Mikheyev, Russia has handed over an offer to India to supply an additional batch of deck-based MiG-29K and MiG-29KUB fighter jets to India for India's Vikrant aircraft carrier. So India needs more of these fighter planes, deck-based fighter planes. India may most likely possibly go for the Rafale, but the Russians would like to try their luck and possibly sell India this fighter plane, which India currently uses, the MiG-29 in its existing aircraft carrier. So, this is another example of the same news. Russia delivers new fighter aircraft offer to India at the Aero India 2023, which just got over in Bengaluru. And once again, this is the same news. So, three different angles, MiG-29K fighter aircraft. What else? Here's something interesting. Russia explores joint production of 100-seater Sukhoi superjet in India. So this is a 100-seater commercial passenger aircraft. So India, we know the Indian aircraft market is expanding. More and more Indians are flying domestically, possibly internationally as well, every year. India needs more aircraft. Air India has gone ahead with the largest aviation deal in aviation history. And the Russians would like to help out. There are other airlines as well. There's IndiGo. There are various other new airlines that are coming up all the time. And there's going to be more of a demand for passenger aircraft. And even if India doesn't go ahead and purchase these aircraft, we could produce them in India. So Russia is proposing this, and it is exploring the joint production of this aircraft in India. So what kind of aircraft is this? Let's take a look at that. Sukhoi Superjet 100. It's a narrow body aircraft, obviously, a regional jet with what is the range? Let's take a look at the range. Where is the range of this aircraft? Range, 98 passengers, 4,500 kilometers. So you could fly from, let's say, New Delhi to Beijing. You could fly, let's go to the map. Where is the map? I'm sure we have a map somewhere. Yeah, so listen, you could fly from New Delhi to Beijing, possibly. You could fly from New Delhi to possibly Cairo or to some regional destinations. But you can't fly from New Delhi to Tokyo, for instance, in this jet. So it's a regional jet. It, you know, any airline that purchases this jet will be able to cover all domestic destinations and destinations in the Persian Gulf, in the UAE, in Indonesia, and in the surrounding regions of India. But it's not a long-range aircraft. So Russia is proposing joint production of this with India. It's an interesting offer, and I'm sure the Indian government will examine this very carefully and very seriously. And it could represent a good opportunity for India if we strike the right deal with the Russians. What else? So now there is an offer of joint production of the Sukhoi 27 stealth fifth generation fighter plane to India. So this aircraft was supposed to be the aircraft on which the Hindustan Aeronautics Limited, HAL, FGFA, fifth generation fighter aircraft, was supposed to be based. There was supposed to be a collaboration between India and Russia. And the Russians messed it up very badly. They were unwilling to share the technology. They took up a lot of Indian, they took a lot of Indian money, and they were unwilling to share the technology with India, despite India paying for a lot of the development. And it was not up to the mark. You know, the stealth features were not good enough and all that. So India eventually left the deal, walked away from the deal, and lost money. So now this fighter plane seems to, I think it is already in service to a certain extent in the Russian Air Force. And they are offering joint production of this to India. Interesting. They are also offering to co-develop the Sukhoi 75 Checkmate fighter plane with India. So this is a fighter plane that's a fifth generation fighter plane. It is in the design process right now. And the Russians are offering that they will co-develop this with India. So India has obviously already had a very bad experience with the Russians when it comes to the Sukhoi 57, the FGFA fighter plane. India has also not had a very good experience when it comes to the development of the new aircraft carrier, which the Russians sold to India. Over there also, they tried to extort a lot of money from India. So India will have to be very careful when it comes to all these things. It should not be that India ends up bankrolling Russia's development of its fighter planes and India doesn't get what it has paid for. Essentially, if you pay for something, you should get the technology and you should be able to manufacture it entirely on your own in India. So yeah, this will be definitely considered by India, but I'm not sure how far it will go. The ideal solution is to develop, for India to develop its own fighter planes in-house. The next generation Tejas fighter plane, the Mark II, the twin-engine deck-based fighter, and the fifth generation AMCA, Advanced Medium Combat Aircraft. So this will take time, maybe a decade or so. But it's certainly something India can do. But I'm sure India will certainly take these offers up seriously. So this is the Sukhoi 75. It's a Wikipedia article about that. There's more. Russia is ready to co-develop main battle tank with India and ready to share T-14 Armata tank technology. The T-14 Armata is considered to be one of the deadliest tanks in the world. It's considered to be a super tank. So the Russians are saying they are ready to share this tank's technology with India. Well, let's take a look at that. I'm sure the government of India will consider this very seriously. And there is more of that cutting edge E-14 Armata technology to India to co-develop the Indian Army's main battle tank. Russia is making all these offers to India. Very interesting news that's come out in the past couple of weeks. I'm sure India will take this, consider this very seriously, examine this seriously, and see if there is any feasibility of doing this. Obviously, the Russians will expect money. And if we do go ahead with this, we have to ensure that we acquire the technology transfer from them and we get what we are paying for. So, yeah, interesting developments happening in these matters. Now, let's take up one more event, one more development. And this is, again, something that Indians are extremely enthused about, which is lithium. Here it is. So, $34 trillion lithium find story could shape India's electric vehicle story. So here's the news. The Geological Survey of India has recently announced the discovery of 5.9 million tons of lithium in Jammu and Kashmir. So that's where it is. So what we have is that we are at the G3 stage. The geological axis has four stages. Reconnaissance is G4. Prospecting is G3. General exploration is G2. And detailed exploration is G1. So we are at G3 right now. So the prospecting has been done. There is about so many tons, about 6 million tons of lithium that has been discovered. So it's been classified as G3. So that's the amount of reserves that we have. We still need to verify it properly that it is indeed that much amount of lithium, or maybe more or maybe less. We have to ascertain that properly. Now, if you look at various charts of lithium reserves worldwide, we see this. It's locked out. Very nice. Thank you. So let's close that. Okay, here's another example. Countries with the largest lithium deposits. Chile has 9.2 million tons in this statistic. India, 5.9. Australia, 5.7. And so on. This is something similar to that. But if you look here, if you look at this BBC article from just a week ago, it says that... what does it say? So Bolivia's lithium reserves are estimated to be at 21 million tons. So that is definitely much higher than Chile, definitely more than double of what Chile has. So it doesn't matter actually who has more, but India now seems to have a very significant quantity of lithium reserves. Now, why is lithium important? Lithium has an atomic number of 3. Lithium is the lightest and least dense metal. It's classified as an alkali element. And its physical properties are such that they make lithium an excellent component, an excellent component of electric batteries. So electric batteries are, something you use everywhere. You use electric batteries in your lithium ion batteries, in your phone, in your smartwatch, in your camera's battery, in your laptop battery, and in electric vehicles. So it is estimated that the average electric car, requires about 33 kilograms of lithium for its battery. So until 2015, in India, electric vehicle manufacturing made up only 30% of the lithium demand. The majority of the lithium demand in India was for other purposes, like smartphone batteries and camera batteries and laptop batteries and all those things. So the EV electric vehicle demand for lithium was about 30% of the demand until 2015. But it is estimated that by 2030, in the next 7 or so years, it is estimated that in India, 95% of the demand is going to be for electric vehicles alone, because the Indian government is now pushing for using electric vehicles. There are these e-rickshaws coming up, and there's this concerted effort to phase out of fossil fuels. So by 2030, most likely it is anticipated that 95% of the demand in India will be for electric vehicles. So the demand for lithium is going to increase significantly by the end of this decade. And this is going to result in a spike, a rise in the prices of lithium. And because of that, the commodities that we purchase, which contain lithium, iron batteries, are going to get more expensive if things go this way. Now, here's the deal. We saw in this in these statistics that it's Chile and it's Latin America, Argentina, Chile, and Bolivia that have the major resources of lithium until now. Over here, it says Bolivia has 21 million tons or so of lithium. So it's the majority of it has thus far been in Latin America. And what's interesting is that the Chinese, they control about 2/3 of the entire global lithium processing capacity. So when it comes to Bolivia, they will be able to mine lithium, but they don't have the ability to process the lithium and purify it. Neither does Chile, neither does Argentina. But China controls 2/3 of the entire world's lithium processing capacity. And the Chinese have been making investments for a long time globally in, you know, acquiring the rights to process the lithium that's mined in various places. And in some places, they will even, enter into agreements to mine lithium. So in the last decade, the 2010s, the Chinese invested more than $5 billion in Bolivia in the lithium industry. And if you look here, in 2023, the Chinese signed a $1 billion additional deal to develop Bolivia's vast lithium reserves. So the Chinese have been making, they have been moving very fast. They have been ahead of the game, ahead of the US, ahead of India, definitely. And they now control 2/3 of the entire world's lithium processing capacity. So when it comes to India, This deposit that we have discovered in Jammu and Kashmir, we have to first ascertain that the quantity is right. We are at G3. We need to go to G1. G3, G1, where is it? G3 means we have done the prospecting. We have to do the general exploration and we have to do the detailed exploration. So that will take time. It's not going to happen tomorrow or next week. So first of all, we have to understand that this deposit that we have discovered will take about a decade or so to develop properly. Yes. So this discovery is not going to impact manufacturing in India until 2030, at least until the mid 2030s. Yes. And so India will have to do the proper prospecting. Then India will have to mine the lithium. So we will have to mine the lithium. Indian companies will be engaged to do the mining activity. But it's not enough to mine the lithium. If India wants to be truly self-sufficient in lithium and become a world leader, exporter, all that, India must focus on not only mining, but also refining the lithium. That's the most important thing. You cannot simply be a raw materials producer. You have to be an end product producer. That's what you have to do. And the intermediate step in that is to refine the lithium. And then India should become a major manufacturer of lithium-ion batteries. So all these steps need to start taking these steps now. The research and development when it comes to lithium ion technology and all these things. So that's what needs to happen. So the government of India needs to ensure that Indian companies should mine the lithium and Indian manufacturers and companies should refine the lithium. So India, the Indian government needs to incentivize Indian companies who are interested in the refining process of the lithium. So this is a great opportunity for India, not just to become self-sufficient in lithium, not just to become an exporter of refined lithium, but to become a world leader in the lithium ion battery technology and electric vehicles and all these things. So overall, it's a great news for India. This is great news, but it's still early days. It's not going to catapult India overnight to global leader status when it comes to lithium. And, you know, we have discovered lithium, 6 million roughly tons in Jammu and Kashmir. I am sure there must be much more lithium in other parts of the country. But the exploration process obviously has not happened to a large extent. I mean, we know that we have at least a quarter of the global thorium reserves, and we still haven't really leveraged that. So it's high time India becomes more ambitious, becomes more proactive, and starts doing these things, which will, you know, benefit India greatly in the next decade and two decades. So yes, so that's what I wanted to talk about today. That brings me to the end of the topics that I had chosen for today. So we're gonna end over here. Thank you very much for watching, and I'm gonna see you in less than 24 hours in the next live stream, which is the Ask Abhijit episode tomorrow night, 9 p.m. India time. Until then, take care. Thank you very much for watching, and I will see you very soon. Thank you. Bye. Good night. Good day. See you soon.